From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, Tony Gilroy, as a writer, has a gift for putting his protagonists and the audience in situations where nobody knows where they are. If we go from the Bourne movies to his directorial debut, Michael Clayton, to his new film, Duplicity, it's always the circumstance where people are figuring out who they are and reacting, and we're reacting along with them. First of all, Tony, thanks for coming back.
Pleasure to be back.
And it really is about that thing with the twist. We look at Dolores Claiborne. Almost everything you've done as a writer, even Cutting Edge, we don't know where we stand, and the characters don't know where they stand either.
I don't set out to work with that as a conscious intention. In this movie, I did. In this movie,
well,
I did. For Duplicity,
here.
I did. It's not something I'm navigating towards all the time, but I'm so afraid of boring you. I so want to hang on to your attention. I'm so craven about needing your attention that I'll do anything to keep you watching. And one of the best ways to keep people interested is to move the ground underneath them.
It's almost, in a weird way, Hitchcockian in that sense where the protagonists almost never knew where they were and they were asking questions at the same time we were as an audience.
But that's life is – you don't know what's going to happen next. That's what life is. That's what great acting is. Great acting is making something happen for the first time over and over again. You know, it's always the first time.
We should say that Duplicity is a heist comedy starring Julia Roberts and Clive Owen. And one of the things I've noticed about the film, especially as compared to stuff Clive Owen's been doing recently, he's looking people in the eye for the first time because – but you don't know what that means when he's looking them directly in the eye. And it's an unusual thing to see him do.
Well, he's played such a hard guy. He's played such a rough and tumble guy all the way up and down the line. When I met him, George Clooney introduced him to me and said, you should get Clive to do Duplicity. And I sat and had a couple drinks with him, and he was so loose and funny and such a bloke. And I thought, God, I haven't seen that on film. It was so perfect for Duplicity. I thought, wow, if I can be the first person to get that on film, I'll be very lucky. And I think that, I mean, I know that that's what we've gone for here. I mean, it really is a different, it is him, but it's a very, very different version of him than you've seen.
You're right. It's what we haven't seen. And he doesn't get that much dialogue often. I mean, he'll have a few lines and then he'll like turn away to brood. And so he's in the conversation with people and fighting and talking and kind of in conversation and throughout the picture in this weird way fighting for his life.
What was great for Duplicity about his previous persona is he has all that. I never have to convince you. I do a little bit in the beginning to make sure to remind you that how tough and cool and man of the world he is. But he so possesses that I don't have to spend a lot of time in the rest of the film building up on that. And I can corrupt the other part of – I can corrupt that all the way through. He's not in charge all the way through this movie. But I don't ever have to reestablish his cool. He comes with a full bag of cool when he starts off.
But one of the fun things must be for you and for him as an actor to see him to do takes, which he never has done in the movie before. He's doing double takes.
You know, he has this rubber face. When you work with somebody, and I spent over a year with him struggling to get the movie made. We really became co-conspirators on this. I think he's the kind of actor. I think he could have worked in silent films. I think he could have worked in the 30s. I think he could have worked all the way through the studio system. I think he could have been a noir actor in the 50s. I don't think there's an era of movie making that he doesn't work. And that's a very unusual. I don't know how many movie stars there you can say that exactly about. He works up and down line. There may be different parts, maybe different things, but he's a very, very gifted comedic actor.
Since you're talking about playing people's perceptions on their ear, you also do that with Julia Roberts here as well. And it's going to be a tough conversation because we can't give a whole lot of the movie away.
No, I know. It's tricky to talk about this one.
Part of the fun must have been for you just having a chance to turn audiences' perceptions on their ears.
Julia was really game for this. She was really up for it right away. We wanted her to do the film, and then she got pregnant. And she came back. There wasn't much tailoring of this part for her. These are scoundrels.
But you like writing scoundrels.
Well, of course. I mean, anybody who's telling a lie is automatically interesting. I mean, there's automatic tension in that. I mean, you're looking for tension all the time. You're looking for conflict. That's just how we – those are the sticks you're rubbing together all the time. In the same way that Clive didn't have to – I never have to sort of reestablish his cool along the way, she has to do something that's sort of the opposite of that, which is that she has to be She's very intelligent and very manipulative and very sneaky in the movie. But there has to be an emotional payoff in it. It really has to get someplace emotionally. And she just has that furnace burning all the time. And it's just you're just waiting to just sort of access it. And the moment we needed it, and it's she brings that underneath everything. So it's and the audience brings that and knows that about her. They know that there's a, you know, she's unique without being unusual, and she has that every woman, you know, identity that's really necessary at the end of this movie to be able to access, so it has an emotional component as well.
This is Treatment. I guess this writer-director, Tony Gilmore, we know him from being here last time for Michael Clayton. He's back for his new film, Duplicity. But you were saying that was a struggle to get the film made.
It was a struggle to get the film made, only in that there weren't a lot of people casting-wise. I wrote the script years ago.
How far back did you do it?
Oh, God, about 7 years ago.
And did you know you wanted to direct it when you wrote
it? No, I wrote it for Steven Soderbergh originally. I met with Steven. It was how I met Steven. And Steven said, oh, I want to do a spy movie. You do all these spy movies. And I said, I'm kind of sick of doing spy movies. And he said, well, I want to do a romance. I want to do like Charade. And I go, I don't really like Charade that much. And he said, well, you know, well, what about spies? And I said, you know, there's one thing about spies right now that's really all the people that I know that are in the intelligence community, they're all going private. I said, no one's really doing anything with corporate espionage. And I think it's really a juicy topic and someone's going to do that. And he got really into that. So we started to meet. And the idea came out of those meetings. And then Universal had the script and it had many. Steven decided he wasn't going to do it. At one point, David Fincher and Brad Pitt were involved. At one point, Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise were involved. It had a long, you know, it had this bubbling Hollywood life the way projects do. And it never quite came together. So it was sort of sitting there while we were shooting Clayton, and I was hoping it wouldn't go away. And no one would, I was hoping no one would take it off the shelf until I got there.
And after Clayton, did you feel like it was the thing to do? Because it's in a way, it's similar but very different to Clayton, because it's there's a sense of fun in it. And usually the stuff, certainly the comedy comes out of character complication for you, but this is where the comedy and character complication are hand in hand.
Yeah, it's very different. You know, I think it's the perfect kind of thing to do next. It's much bigger. It's much more – I learned a lot of more filmmaking. It's a lot more filmmaking in this than the other, and it's a bigger production, and it's – comedy is a whole different exercise. I'm very happy I chose it.
It's got so many set pieces in it, which are built on dialogue.
Right.
Which – it's very different because I think as a director, Michael Clayton, you were almost kind of servicing the script, and it felt like you knew if you cast the right actors, the storytelling would do the work for you. But here you had to really step up in a way.
In what way? What do you mean?
Because I think here we can't know where we stand.
Right.
And in Michael Clayton, people sort of constantly trying to tell us where they were. And here, when people are saying what they want, it's very different from what's actually happening.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you know? I mean, actually, I got a lot more visual chops. You know, we got
yeah, exactly.
I had the same people that we brought back. I had my same crew from Clayton. Clayton wanted to be very still. Clayton is very, very still. It's all about framing. Robert Ellswood and I were just hyper conscious of
and cinematographer, Robert.
Cinematographer, yeah. Making the film anamorphically and the color palette and framing and not moving the camera very much and letting people walk in and out of frame and, you know, stealing a lot from a lot of directors that we admired that had done that. And this was very different. I mean, when Robert came in, I said, all right, well, I still want to go anamorphic, but this is much more candy and there's a lot of things we want to really be moving the camera. But again, moving it in a formal way. There's only one scene in the film that's handheld, and it's very consciously there for a reason to be that way.
It feels like a big old-fashioned studio movie in a lot of ways.
It kind of is in that sense. I mean, it really is. Big actors, big moments, big scenes. It's sort of one big scene after another.
You have two back-to-back in the very beginning. I mean, the credit sequence in the opening. And I thought that it makes it pop.
And big New York and, yeah, big streets. And we go to Rome and we go to the Bahamas. It's very... Someone said, it was a smart candy, you know, big smart candy movie. It wanted to be shiny and pretty people. And
did you know that when you set out with it?
Was always in the, you know, and even writing for Steven in the beginning, this was pre-Oceans, really, I guess. And it was, you know, but it was in that sort of, you know, that idea of gloss, that idea of polish on something. You know, you just sort of get a color palette in your head even while you're writing. You know, what's the color? Yeah, I mean, what's the level of sheen on this in a way? I don't know. There's a smell about things as you're working on them that both Clayton and this were They smell, the movie smells to me like when I was working on the script, what I was going for.
It's a treatment. My guest is the writer, director of the new movie Duplicity, Tony Gilroy. He also did Michael Clayton as a directorial debut. In these conversations with the other directors who were on it, did the talk of Candy come up kind of constantly?
You know, David Fincher had a very I spent 3 weeks with David Fincher, and it was very exciting working on the script and working with him. And his version of the script, his version of it was very sexual. He wanted to do a very, very sexual version of it. He wanted to do it as an R. He wanted to do it really. That was his take on it.
Did that feel right to you, having it
you
be that
what?
Hard
I was
and
a
sexual?
Willing Culkin. He's a very persuasive advocate for his point of view. I mean, he was the director, and I was making that happen. The director is the director, and he wasn't tearing it apart. He wasn't tearing at the fun of it. But he was really interested in the sexual tension of trust, I suppose. There's a lot of this movie's about trust and two people who are sort of really turned on by not trusting.
And the sexual politics are a big part of it.
Very
too, still.
Yeah, exactly. And who's on top in every way is part of what's going on here. So it's a viable take. We never went farther than 3 weeks, though, so who knows what would have happened along the line.
And with Spielberg, when you were talking with him,
that incarnation was with Tom Cruise. And that, I don't know, we spent probably a month in conversation and did a table read. And my memory is that, you know, Catch Me If You Can, that was sort of the
tone?
Yeah, I kind of think, when I look at, we actually looked at that movie a lot when we were setting this up. That movie catches a very, very cool tone. I like that movie a lot. I like how that movie smells in that way. I like the
it's got those candy colors you're talking about,
and it
too.
Also, yeah, it also has, you know, it's the trick is to, you know, be able to have those colors and have that soundtrack and have that going on and yet be, you know, microscopically real about behavior and have things really have cause and effect for behavior. So it's not that you throw out psychology and logic when you add those things. They're not exclusive. They can work together. And a lot of movies used to do that. It's less and less.
You've also got to keep that velocity going, and which wasn't so much the key with Michael Clayton. It wasn't about the speed of the vehicle, but you've got to keep this thing in motion so people are asking questions of the characters, and it's got to move fast enough so they can't try to go two steps ahead of you.
Yeah, there's two parts to that. One is because the story is so sort of quick and complicated, and you want to keep the tempo moving, but there's a lot of information, and because everyone is messing with everyone so much, and because there's very little solid ground as the movie goes along, we worked a lot harder in the editing room than I ever thought that we would, trying to keep the IQ of the movie up and let it go down easy. And I learned a tremendous amount. I learned from my brother and with my brother, John Gilroy, my brother, who's the editor of Duplicity and was the editor of Michael Clayton, about how to make that happen.
Were you concerned about that? Because I'm just – because it's a really
tough
thing to pull off.
Oh, it's really – a lot of work went into making it clear. And I would say that the cut really kind of, you know, came together pretty quickly. But all the little tricky things that we did all the way down the line to make sure that we were never dumbing the movie down at all but making it understandable, that was a whole education in itself. In terms of navigating through the movie, comedy is really hard. It was much more complicated than doing Clayton in that sense, trying to follow that every day.
We'll take a break. My guest is writer-director Tony Gilroy. His new film is Duplicity. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Tony Gilroy. His fun new film is Duplicity with Clive Owen and Julia Roberts. As you talk about this, though, I guess what I find myself thinking is that in Clayton, you were allowed to have a certain kind of ambiguity where even though people are, you want to confuse people a little bit, there's still got to be clarity in comedy, doesn't there?
I think the last time I was here, we talked a lot about Sidney Pollack.
Yeah.
And I had a very important conversation with Sidney when he was sick. And, you know, he'd call him on the phone.
And we should remind people he's passed away.
Well, yeah.
And he was a great part of Michael Clayton.
He was a great part. And he became a really good friend. And while he was sick, when I was getting ready to do this, I started to get nervous about doing the comedy. And I'd been watching Tootsie. I'd been watching some movies that caught a line of reality and comedy. And I called Sidney up one day just to see how he's doing and said, oh, you know, I've been watching Tootsie a lot. And why? And I said, well, I'm going to do this Duplicity, and I'm nervous about it. And he told me the greatest story. He said when he was getting ready to do Tootsie, he was a few weeks out from shooting, and he went and saw, I think, Victor Victoria, and he had a panic attack. He said, I looked at that movie, and I realized I could never do this comedy. I can never be funny. I don't know anything about how to do that, what Blake Edwards is doing. I should not be doing this movie, Tootsie. It's a huge mistake. And he basically, I think, picked up the phone and tried to call the movie off, like 3 weeks out. You know, this panic, director's panic before you start. And people just, you know, obviously he made the film. But he said what he decided after that weekend was he would never chase the comedy. He would direct every single scene as if it was completely serious, as if every scene was Chekhov. He said it was a boring set. He said there was very little laughter on the set. He goes, it never came together until the very end. And that conversation really, that was a very true thing to stay to. You cannot chase it.
No. You also have to maintain the reality of the piece too.
Every minute. It's almost, you know, you go to do Clayton or you do a movie that's like that, you lower the thermostat every day you go to work. You just turn it down. It's cold in here. Nobody likes each other. It's cold. It's unpleasant, you know. It's pretty simple. It's hard. Everything's hard. No one gets along. Everything's hard. Nothing's funny. You just set that every day. And I got, you know, big personalities. I got Paul Giamatti, and I got Tom Wilkinson, and I've got Clive, and I've got Julian, and I've got Kathleen Chalfant, and Dennis. I've got all these actors that just, you know, and keeping everybody as straight and down the middle as possible and trusting, praying that it's all going to be effervescent when you finish up is really – Sidney was right. I would so love for him to see the movie.
I guess I'd like to talk a little bit, too, about, because you were getting it near the end of the last interview, about how much Taylor Hackford did for you. You spent a lot of time with him. And there's also that thing, too, where his movies often move very fast. We think back to, of course, The Devil's Advocate,
right,
where you guys worked together. And there was that kind of sense of speed on that, too. It was a strain.
There's a lot of scenes in that movie, yeah.
Yeah. And in a way, because I thought about this, because I ended up watching it again before we sat down to talk. And there are set pieces in that, too, almost back-to-back, that sort of... But at least one person in that movie knows exactly what's going on all the time.
There is one person who knows everything in that movie.
And
I haven't seen it in a while.
But it was fun to watch it because I found myself seeing bits of that here. Because often when people put scenes back to back, they're big action scenes. But they don't put big, intense sort of dialogue scenes back to back. And it's an interesting thing to do. And I wonder if that was something
I don't have any big action scenes.
But you know what I'm saying, because we had a conversation about a movie before we got started.
But
the idea of putting big – usually when there's a big dialogue scene, filmmakers tend to give it some space.
There are no little scenes, though. Every scene is just critical. I don't know.
But that's what I'm saying to you, though.
For me, every page is just – if there isn't something essential happening, there's something wrong.
But
there's no casual moments of anything I'm doing. Now, that may be stylistic. I don't know.
But you know what I'm saying, that often – I'm not talking about your work, but often filmmakers, when there's a big dialogue scene, the next scene will give it a little bit of space. You'll give it a little bit of air. You know, it could give the audience a chance to sort of take a deep breath and figure out what's happening.
I'm not doing that.
You've never done that. I find myself wondering if Hackford was somebody who gave you confidence to do that, or if that was the way you always felt about doing these things.
I got so much from Taylor. And on this movie... Every time I go to the set, I realize more and more how many things I've learned and stolen from Taylor. I do think that there's something, going back to what we said in the beginning, I do think that I am absolutely, I think I'm so cruel to myself And so terrified that I will lose your attention, I'm very, very conscious of being propulsive all the time. I really want things to move. I want to get out of every scene as early as I possibly can. I want to get in as late as possible. It's very rare you'll see a scene where I have somebody say hello and goodbye in a scene. I'm always, and I really want to move. And I write that way, and I edit that way, and I don't know. I think it's. I'm not sure if I could do McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You know, I mean, I look at that movie and I love that movie so much, and I don't, and I love it in the way that I don't quite understand how it's. I mean, I understand how it's made, but I don't understand the process of it. I watched Let the Right One In the other day, and I watch it, and it's, and I couldn't do that movie.
But that's almost all atmosphere of that movie.
I know, but I loved it. And it hung on me for, and those movies both, they both have a lingering effect. That movie's been hanging on me for weeks, the vampire movie. That's not in my species or genus or whatever it is.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Tony Gilroy. His new film is Duplicity. Because you're talking about Sidney, and Sidney often, when there were big dramatic moments, he would give the movie space afterwards. You think about his movies that did that.
Right.
When there was a big conflict.
Right.
With the exception of Tootsie, generally, when there's a big moment, a big reveal, then there's like, you sort of, he would let you watch the actors.
Right.
And that's not something that you've done as a writer on your own.
I'm going to work on that, Elvis.
This is not a suggestion. Because I think it's really kind of daring and asks a lot of the audience. And I just wonder, when actors get these scripts, what they say when they see what the way these things are constructed.
I think actors, even great actors, I think by and large, they really look at rhythm of the character. They look at what the character does, how they're going to look, what kind of vibe they're going to play. And I think that really... I think my best sales pitch for actors has always been, you know, I think my dialogue sits really well rhythmically for them, and I think the internal tempo. I think they look at inside every scene. Could I say those words? Can I be cool in this? Can I be interesting in this? Can I emotionally get someplace in this that I need to get? And does the dialogue need to be rewritten? I think how dialogue sits for actors is finally. It's sort of the clothes they're putting on last. It's the last thing they're putting on before they go out. And they're sort of naked until that point. And I think that the fact that the dialogue sits really well and that I can change it to sit really well is an excuse for me not being able to get involved in the emotional life of the actor, you know, and direct in that fashion.
I like this conversation because there are so many things. And again, watching Devil's Advocate to get ready for this. There's often somebody asking somebody else if you're weak. I mean, basically, somebody asks somebody to man up in
right.
your work. I mean, and it's very much, even though it's Julia Roberts saying it to Clive Owen, here, it's still happening. You got to, like, step up and be a man. And that's a fascinating thing. You go back to the cutting edge. I mean, there's all this kind of, are you tough enough? Are you big enough to do this? And these questions are kind of, I don't want to cowardice, but basically almost like calling somebody a girl. You know, are you a man or what are you? That's a big part of what you've done.
Do I do that in Dolores Claiborne? I guess I do too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's basically saying, yeah. I don't mean to put you
on the
spot. I
got a lot to think about when I go home, Elvis. I didn't realize this was going to be – all right.
I'm sorry.
This is very therapeutic.
No, it is maybe for me, but you're not answering anything, dude. No, I mean, I just find this to be really
– I'm not aware of that. I'm not
– Okay.
These are all things I'm not aware of.
Then what are you aware of when you sit down and write? Let me ask you that.
I'm aware
besides not wanting to bore people, which is your
basic
tenet.
Yeah, no, but I mean, Duplicity is probably a little bit different than most of the things I've done. Most of everything else starts with a character. You know, I mean, Devil's Advocate started with a script that wasn't working and came in and how do you find a way to make that character interesting? So, again, though, made a character, you know, made the father, made Pacino his father, made it all internal, found it, put it all in the character. Clayton, wow, what an interesting job. I've had a guy who's a fixer at a law firm. That's a really interesting gig. He's at the middle of a lot of different things. And I played with that for a long, long time. That is typically how I'll start. And it all start from a character and work its way out. This was a little bit different because these conversations with Stephen were, oh, let's do a movie about corporate espionage. It should be a romance. They should be retired spies. These are all sort of instantaneous givens. And very early on in the conversation, in the meetings with Steven, I said, you know, it'd be really great if there was a conversation in this movie that you heard, you know, 3, 4, 5 times, and every time you heard it, it meant something else. I said, I'd love to do that. And that's the kind of mega idea that Steven just jumps all over. Oh, yeah, let's do that. I like that idea. Theoretically, I don't even know if it's what that means, but let's do that. and that sort of built itself in there. So this was a little bit built more off of a different kind of blueprint. But I'll probably try to start writing something in April when I get off the road. And, you know, the 4 or 5 things that are like at the front of my head are all job descriptions.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's really what it is.
They're job descriptions, in effect. You know, job descriptions and a situation. Someone in a job or someone doing something that I find interesting that seems like it might be at the nexus of, you know, tension, passion, crime, something or other.
It's the treatment. My guest is the writer, director of the new movie Duplicity, Tony Gilroy. He also did Michael Clayton as a directorial debut. These people, certainly Clive and Julia, are defining themselves by what they do. I mean, you know.
There's a lot of work in this movie. To tell you the truth, of all the spy movies I ever wrote, this one has the most espionage in it. The espionage and tradecraft in this is actually.
How much research did that require?
This was pretty easy to research. I knew some people that had left and gone private. This is a huge, this corporate espionage thing is enormous. There isn't a major corporation out there that doesn't have at least a defensive, they call it competitive intelligence is what they call it. That's the euphemism for it. And there's actually a trade association, and they have conventions, and they spend a lot of time making sure that everybody understands that there's a whole code of ethics to it, and that most of it involves looking at public records and doing things like that. But there's no shortage of anecdotal material available. I mean, you can Google this and just go nuts with it. You find all these things. There isn't anything that happens in this movie, as crazy as some of the stuff is, that hasn't happened. Seriously, all of it. You know, you could sort of go through and footnote it all if you wanted to. I don't want to do that for a whole variety of legal reasons. But I was
just going to get to that question of were there specific incidents that triggered this for you as you were doing the research or pieces of anecdotal information that you
There's
found?
One thing that's on the record. Procter & Gamble and Unilever had a very public – most of the time this never reaches the news because the winner doesn't want to talk about something they stole from somebody and the loser doesn't want to talk about it. The economics are if you spend $60 million developing a product over the course of 4 or 5 years and I can spend $2 million in intelligence hiring professionals and stealing that idea, I can basically have your idea for $2 million that you've spent all this money on. I can either, you know, program against you or I can steal the idea outright. It's a huge thing. But you don't want to talk about it when I steal it from you and I don't want to. Procter & Gamble and Unilever were forced to go public some years ago in a war about dumpster diving, about stealing their garbage. Everyone admits that that's just this little microscopic tip of the iceberg that sort of showed its face up. There's an enormous amount of energy and money that goes into corporate espionage. People are completely unaware of it. It's a very juicy topic. So there's a lot of work and a lot of espionage in here.
And unfortunately, we're out of time. Tony, okay. Please, anytime, you're more than welcome to come back anytime you want.
I love it here. Okay.
My guest is Tony Gilroy. His new film starring Clive Owen and Julie Roberts is Duplicity. A recording engineer at Argo Network in New York is Paul Ruess. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey, the producer. I know nothing. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.